You're listening to the ILFD podcast, where we take a dive into the International Literature Festival Dublin archives and share some of our favorite conversations from years past. Today, we're listening to authors Kirsty Logan and Anya Bergman discuss witches in literature with moderator Sarah Maria Griffin from the 2023 edition of ILFD. Starting off with a reading from Anya's book, The Witches of Vardo, followed by a reading from Kirsty's book, Now She Is Witch. Perfect for the Halloween season.
Hello, everyone. Thank you so much for coming. Myself and Kirsty are very excited to be talking with you tonight. So I'm going to read, the first little bit I'm going to read is from the first chapter of my book, so no spoilers. And just to introduce it a little bit, we have a character, the first character you meet in The Witches of Vardo is a woman called Anna Rudius, and she has been exiled to the island of Vardo in the very far north of Norway for being a pain in the arse, basically, for annoying the king of Denmark. So I'm reading the end part of this chapter. She's just got off the boat. She's pretty horrified about where she is. It's so cold and bleak and desolate, and she's being transported by sleigh to the fortress where she's going to be imprisoned. So, we tumbled beneath the silvered northern sky for hours. My bones rattled and my joints sore. My eyelids were falling, lulled by an image in my head. I knelt before my king, dressed in my best blue silk gown, and your hand, bejeweled with gems, was resting upon my head. I could feel the gratitude from your palm crowning me. I was wrenched from my reverie by the sound of the driver crying out. I could see the rumps of the reindeer out of formation, skittering about on the treacherous snow. Bailiff Lockhart roared to hold steady, but it was no use, for the sleigh had lost control. It skidded across the ice and mounted a drift of snow so high I had to cling onto the wooden sides of the sleigh so as not to fall upon my head. I braced myself to turn full circle, terrified I would break my bones. But instead, we thumped back down upon the packed snow and skidded to a halt. My hat had fallen over my face, and I could hear the heavy thump of Lockhart's boots landing in the snow. I pushed my hat back and could see his hulking figure striding away while the driver was soothing the startled reindeer. Neither man had attended to my welfare. I dragged myself out of the overturned sleigh, looking to see where my precious medicine chest might have landed. It was a short distance away, its contents strewn upon the snow and lit up by the moon. As I stumbled over towards it, I saw the most astonishing sight. Standing the other side of my chest was a dark-skinned girl, not quite a woman, with black hair unbound, dressed in a cloak of feathers. And most astonishing, by her side was a big wild cat. I had never seen such a creature before. Its soft fur was spotted lightly, and it had an underbelly of purest white. It had big ears tapered with long tufts of fur upon them. Its eyes were the colour of amber stone, and they gazed at me steadily, unafraid, unflinching. In this encounter with the girl, the cat, and me, the air was as if made of fine glass. My breath plumed in heavy puffs, but despite the cold, the girl did not so much as shiver. She put her hand upon the great cat's head, which continued to stare at me, but it was the girl who bared her teeth, not the animal. My heart leapt in fright, for I'd never seen a human, let alone a young woman, make such an expression. The strange girl shook her head, her snarl turning into a peal of laughter, as if delighted to frighten me. "Who are you?" I called out. But she opened her arms so her cape of feathers turned into two big wings, and then she disappeared into a copse of silvery birch, the big cat at her heels. I hastily retrieved the contents of my medicine chest, fearful the girl and the beast would return. But when I looked up again, chest clutched tight in my hands, I saw Lockhart running back from the woods, a bow and arrow over his shoulder. "Did you get it?" the driver asked him, securing the harnesses of the jittery reindeer. "No, it was too fast," Lockhart replied. "What's a lynx doing in these parts?" The old man shrugged. The other man shrugged. Of course, it was a lynx. I had heard of these large cats of the northern regions. How magnificent a cloak of its soft, lustrous fur would be. "And the girl?" I asked, dusting snow off my cape. "What of the girl?" Lockhart turned and frowned at me. "What are you raving about?" "There was a young woman with the lynx," I persisted. "Did you not see her? She had long black hair and wore a cloak of feathers." I trailed off, realizing how unlikely this sounded. We are 2 hours' ride from the nearest village, so who do you think might be running around in the woods with a lynx? Lockhart challenged me with a sneer to his voice. She was right there, I insisted, and she threatened me. Enough! I've been warned of your wagging tongue, but this is hysteria from an old hag. My body stiffened from the insults. I had been called old before. Indeed, when he was close up, I could see. I had fewer years on my captor, for the begrimed wrinkles were dug deep in Lockhart's face. How dare you? But before I could finish, he placed his filthy hand upon my mouth. Shut it, he said, spit landing on my forehead. Your transportation has caused us enough trouble. With that, he took a chain from his belt and began to wind it around my wrists. In all my weeks of captivity, even during the trial, I had not been treated with such indignity. I tried to struggle, but he pushed his hand into my chest so hard it felt he might break my heart. Though, my king, my heart was already broken. With the sleigh righted and the reindeer calmed, we set off again. Lockhart had chained me up so tight I could not move and was forced to lie on my back. I stared up at the immense silver of the Martyr Moon with fury coursing through every part of me. I drank in the light of the moon and made an oath. I would not be a martyr, excepting mute and humble, for it was against my very nature. The image of the snarling girl rose up before me. There had been a moment of recognition, strange and without reason. I was sure, certain she had been real, but I could make no sense of it. Mm. Da-da-da.
Shall I leap straight in?
Yeah.
Okay. Hi. I'm Kirsty. Thank you so much for being here. I'm going to lower the tone. And I'm going to read a horny bit. It's very short. And I'm going to read from Now She Is Witch. And I'm going to read you. There are two main characters. We have Lux and we have Else. So I'll read you a little bit of Else later. I'm going to read you a little bit of Lux, who is a teenage girl. She's very hungry, she's very bored, she's very horny, as you will see. So, this is in a part of the book where she's in a sanctuary, a sort of home for wayward girls in the Middle Ages. In the church where we spend much of our time, more time than we spend in our beds anyway, which I am not best pleased about, which is not a blessed thing to think, I know, but it's hard to be holy when you're barely clinging to wakefulness and always slipping into dreams. Anyway, we are in church. Strange to think how quick I am used to this new life, different as it is to the one in the forest with my mother. Then our days were set by the sun and moon and the things we grew, and now our days are set by God only. Or rather the men who God speaks through, because of course he does not speak to us, we are only girls. But there in church with us is our Lord. On his cross he looks so tall up there, even bigger than a real man. Though it's hard to tell, he is high up on the wall watching over us. Or that is what Father Fleck says, but I don't think he is watching us. Because his eyes are raised up, ecstatic, to heaven. And it makes me think of what Gristle said about boys and how when they spend, their eyes roll back like that. And I look at our Lord with his eyes rolled back and I think about him and whether I could make his eyes roll back. This is not holy to think, not holy at all, but I am a wicked, filthy thing and I'm doing my best despite my thoughts. And there in church, I am not watching our Lord and I am not watching Father Fleck. I am watching him. With his head bowed, praying, murmuring words to God. And then his eyes open just a little. He looks over at me. And in a gap between prayers, he looks at me, his eyes steady, and he bites his lip. I see his white teeth appear and dig into his bottom lip so hard it must bleed. Later, when I am washing myself, I find a bite mark. High on my thigh, a bite mark. I cannot know the pattern of his teeth, but I am sure they are his. I am in a swoon at that. It is a miracle. It is a true holy miracle. But Janet cries out. She has a bite on her thigh. How could it be so? And one by one, Isabel, Gristle, Marion, Ignis, Gillis, Elizabeth, Alison, Jehan, Hannah, Isidore, Owen, Euphemia, one by one, we all call out. We are bitten. And I look at all the other girls' bites, and they do not look like bites to me, but more like a bruise, a pinch, like the thumb and finger of a girl might make. Mine, though, is a bite, a real bite, I'm sure of it. but I do not say that. I go to bed and lie awake and think of him there in church biting his lip, and I put my finger to the teeth marks high on my thigh, and I touch them. Thank you.
Unreal. That's warmed up so much, I could take my jacket off.
From the very cold to the very warm, very suddenly. Thank you so much. First of all, before we get into the meat of it, both of you have written these books at very different points in your writing careers. Anya, this is your first novel and has recently been shortlisted for the Kerry Group First Novel of the Year, which is fantastic news. And Kirsty, this is your third novel, among other short story collections and things like that. Can you talk to me a little bit about the points at which you are with work and what led you to these stories in particular? Because both of them have a lot in common, which we will get into. They're very different, but they have beautiful interlocking threads, which we're going to explore as we talk. But can you talk to me a bit about your point and your process?
I'm going to make a confession now. It's not my first novel. It's my 14th novel.
14th? You're way ahead of me.
You're way over here.
I'm old. So, but it's my first as Anya Bergman.
As Anya Bergman.
Reincarnated as Anya Bergman.
Ah, so well there, that's even a deeper depth, because at 14, stories deep, and yourself, and with your own journeys, where, like, why this book and why now is the question that I have to ask.
Do you want me to go first?
Yeah, okay. Or I will.
Well, I mean, with this story, for The Witches of Varda. I came across this story when I was living in Norway, and I've always been very interested in the history of witch trials. I've always loved history, and I've always been quite surprised by how little has been written about it, how little was written about it in fiction, as well as its, kind of lack of featuring in history curriculums and schools and things. So I've always been interested in that. And then I came across the real witch trial records that were recorded in Finnmark during the 17th century. Unfortunately for me, because they're in old Norwegian, they were translated into English. And so about 10 years ago, I began researching those witch trials in Norway, and I just became obsessed. And it became a very personal thing because I felt a responsibility to, I guess, raise the voices of these women in the right way that had been persecuted in Norway and had been executed for witchcraft. And so I just dug deeper and deeper, and it just took a long time to get the story right. I was writing other books at the same time, but it just took a long time to get that right balance so that I was authentic to the real history, but also creating a storytelling that was going to engage the reader.
Of course.
So it's my seventh book. It's the third novel, as you said, but I've written also short stories and memoir and audio novels and that kind of thing. It took me such a long time. It took me 6 years to write this. I mean, I did other stuff in the meantime. Like there was a pandemic, don't know if you heard about it. And I had a baby and did stuff, you know. But really long time. So I started it probably 8 years ago. And nobody was particularly interested in witches then, but it's really hit this like upswell of witch stories, which I think just shows that it's something that's been on a lot of people's minds for a long time. It takes a really long time to write a book. So when you see a wave of similar things come out, nobody can really be copying anyone because it takes so long. It just means we're all swimming in these cultural waters and thinking about these things. I'm not authentic, like Anya. It's very heavily researched, but it's not historically accurate. Please do not come to me for historical accuracy. That is not what I provide at all. What got me really interested in simultaneously the Middle Ages and witchcraft, because actually the witch trials were slightly sort of post-medieval, so I'm already messing around with history at this point. But what really interested me in the Middle Ages was it seemed very comparable to now. This sense of not really knowing what's true or what's real at any point. Most people, particularly, my characters, they're poor. They've never traveled. They would never have traveled further than a day's ride or a day's walk, really, because they don't even have anything on which to ride, a horse or anything like that. So they've never gone more than a day's walk from their home. So all they know of the outside world being, something between a few miles from their home is just what they hear. And they have no way to check any of this. And it seemed really comparable to now, where we hear through social media, through the internet, through everything, all these stories, we really don't know what's real and what's not real. There's this real playing around in this kind of, I think, really beautiful liminal space of realism and belief, I suppose. Like, I'm really not a believer in woo-woo, except I'm not a believer either. And I think a lot of people are living in that space. You know, I am fascinated by anything to do with the unexplained or belief, things that we can't prove. And I'm very much like the Scully. If there's any X-Files fans in here, that was a bit of a 90s throwback there. Like, I don't believe anything. I'm an absolute skeptic. However, I read my horoscope. I love tarot cards. I do have crystals. Do I believe it has any kind of power? Not really, but then I obviously believe something. So I think I also exist in this sort of liminal space of belief and faith, and but wanting proof of some kind. And for me, with witches, it was the same as well. It was this kind of moving beyond this very simplistic binary. Because I think for a long time, you know, the belief was witches are evil. They make pacts with the devil. They eat babies, all this kind of stuff. Evil, evil. And then there was a reclaiming in the sort of 1960s, 70s. There was this reclaiming of witches. You know, they were healers, they were midwives, they didn't do anything wrong. Witch accusations were all just about misogyny. That's all it was, an attack on women. And I didn't really think either of those had to be true. I thought, can't it be more complicated than that? And I got very interested in the Pendle witches, which is a very famous witch case in England, in Yorkshire. And it was a group of a sort of, I guess you would call it a blended family nowadays, of all single mothers. These two families who lived in this sort of abandoned tower called Malkin Tower, just outside the town. And they were disabled and they were poor and there were no men on the scene and everybody hated them because they were a pain. They were an absolute pain. And they would beg because they didn't have anything. And if people wouldn't give them food or shelter or whatever they wanted, they would threaten to put a curse on them. So nobody liked them. And they got accused of witchcraft because nobody liked them. And I don't think that they were nice. I don't think that they were just sitting innocently doing their knitting, not bothering anyone. They got in people's faces and they were unpleasant and they threatened people. And why shouldn't they? You know, they didn't have any power. And this is what I really want to explore in this book. When people have no power, they have to take power. Power just doesn't sit around waiting to be given. It has to be taken. And the easiest way to take power is to take it from someone who has less, unfortunately. We don't punch up, we punch down. So that's really what I wanted to explore. What if witches aren't evil, but they aren't innocent either? That was a very long answer.
No, but it's a really good space to look at, that idea of, like, troublesome women, women who pose a problem. Both works have women who pose problems to power hierarchies and who are punished very deeply for that. And that requisite of good behaviour and kindness and niceness is completely subverted in both cases, and around education and around healing and things that women weren't supposed to be doing but were, despite what they were told to do in this very strict social hierarchy and very violent social hierarchy. The first question that I had about witches proper is, each book is littered and kind of jeweled with shreds of tiny superstitions and folklores. And even on a how woo are you kind of question, which is your favourite one? Like, there's a lovely mention in the earlier parts of your book, Anya, about I've heard this before, about an eggshell. You have to crush your eggshells once you have broken an egg because the witches will use them for boats. And I've heard this one throughout my own life. So seeing
I still
it
do that.
Back,
yeah.
I still do it. I still use them. Just give them a little squish. Mm-hmm. I don't live anywhere near the sea, just in case. And there's lovely litanies of them. In your work, Christy, the one that stuck with me is waking up one morning and the dew on the grass is all blood, red dew. I want to ask what your favourite tiny shreds of superstitions and folklore that you came upon in your research.
Go first.
I love even from the deepest annals of history, we've been saying weird stuff to each other about things that happen or may happen. And we do crush eggshells. I occasionally am prone to throwing a little salt over my shoulder. There are these tiny practices. And on your journeys, I want to know what one stuck with you. Even if you don't practice it, what one landed with you heavy?
No, my favorite one's actually ones that I made up, because I wasn't raised with any religion, and I was always fascinated by religion as a child. My granny was Christian, and my uncle was Buddhist, and I had a lot of different books of mythology, and I had books of Bible stories, I had books of Egyptian gods, Greek gods, all kinds of things. And they were all presented to me just as stories. They weren't presented to me as like, these ones are true, but these ones are made up. They were just all presented to me as just like, these aren't these great stories. Yes, they are, thank you. And my wife is she was raised Catholic. I was gonna say she's a lapsed Catholic. She's firmly given up Catholicism. Actually, when we watched that film Spotlight, she was just like, I can't do this anymore. That was just her journey. That really affected her quite
intensely.
I remember
it so clearly. It was a very hard watch, but also a very galvanizing and radicalizing watch, I think, at the same time.
Yeah, but I mean, she still holds on to certain things from it. Like when my grandpa died, she said some prayers for me, and neither of us particularly believed, but I took such comfort in the prayers, and I thought the words of the prayers were so beautiful, and I just enjoyed the ritual of it. And actually, that's what I was doing. So my first book, The Grace Keepers, came about from that, because when my dad died, I didn't have a sort of formalized grief process, and I was very envious of people who had religions where you had to do certain things, you had to wear certain colors or say certain things, and it was a way to mark the time of the grief. So it was almost like you would know how long it would take. And, you know, I'd been reading about in Victorian times where you wore certain colors, you know, you wore black for a certain time, and then you could have gray, and then you could have purple. And it was also a way of sort of showing that you were grieving to the outside world. And I was very envious. I was really envious of all of this. So I made up a world where there are birds in cages and you don't feed them, and then the lifespan of the bird is the mourning period for the person who had died, which is completely made up.
And the language of that is brilliant, because the birds are called graces. Mm-hmm. So the longer that you give the grace is your grieving period, which is just linguistically beautiful, I think.
Oh, thank you. That actually came about, I made a typo in the thing. I was trying to write graveyard and I wrote graceyard, and I thought, oh, I like that. I'm going to do something with that. And then in my second novel, which was The Gloaming, it's set on an island, and there's a family, and the girls in the family do a sort of ritual where they say, let the sea take it. So at night they go down to the sea, and you kind of, it's like a confession, like a sort of secular confession, because I was very envious of confession as well.
Oh, don't be. It's hard going on all of us.
I'll say, from someone who's never actually been to confession, from the outside it seemed fabulous and fascinating and sort of glamorous, but I was very envious of it, so I thought, I'm going to make up like a secular confession. So they confess to the sea, and then you sort of push it away, and you say, let the sea take it. And the sea will just take whatever you don't want, whatever you can't hold within yourself anymore, you put it in the sea and you take it away. And then in this one, I did a thing where it's to do with leeches, because I was like, I can't write a book about the Middle Ages and not have any leeches, right? So the girls, I like teenage girl rituals as well. I'm very, very into that. I had a lot of rituals as a teenager, and still do now, actually. But so what they do is you put the leech on your thigh, and then when it gets really fat with your blood, it's all really cruel. I don't do any of these things in real life to any of these animals, by the way. This is all fictional. You put it in a hot pan, and when the blood comes out of the leech, it makes the letter of the man you're going to marry, which is made up. I just made that up. But I like that. I like to sort of make
a bit
up
like the
these
apple
rituals.
Peeling.
Exactly.
Isn't it?
Yeah. But I was like, I'll do a leech version of the apple peel.
Yeah. God. And what about you, Anya?
I'm kind of thinking about that, because I don't feel there's so much ritual as such in my book, but there's
the signals, the stories,
the stories, and there's folk
and
tales
threats within those, right?
So it's kind of converging. A lot of the storytelling that was going on at that time in the 17th century was in the far north of Norway, was kind of a mix of Norse mythology, of Sami folk tales, and of old Nordic folk tales. So I kind of read a mix of those, and then I kind of brought my own retellings to them. But I think as well, when you're reading the trial records, you know, you have these confessions from the women accused of witchcraft, and these confessions in themselves
are beautiful stories. They're amazingly rich, stories of how they came to meet the devil, how they danced together with the devil, furnished with lots of little details, funny details about how, you know, the devil took Marlon down to the Valley of Hell and he cooked her a leg of ham in the boiling water. And, you know, it would be funny if it wasn't so awful what the consequence of that confession was. But I thought a lot about why did they confess so intricately all these little details. And I kind of got to the conclusion that these enforced narratives, and they were enforced because they were tortured to confess and denounce, was their last moment. They knew they were doomed, and it was their last moment to show their own individual selves. And so that's when they showed all that part of the oral storytelling they'd grown up with, and the little rituals maybe. They had little charms that they sang, and, one of the rituals that I really liked that they would describe themselves doing to create weather magic would be holding a kerchief at each corner and then letting it go, saying wind in the name of the devil, and turning into birds again feature very strongly. And so for me, what kind of really impacted was when I went up to Varda, and then I actually saw in the nature that storytelling as well. So how they were talking about themselves as birds, I saw all the different seabirds screeching in the sky, and I thought, oh yes, that, you know, I can totally see how they thought these were witches, you know? So I guess I've
incredible.
Thought about lots of
the
favorite
idea
bits,
that
but
it's just one chance to tell the story of your life before it's taken from you, and you've been forced into this corner. So in these last moments and in these final crucial times, you really do tell the full true story of your existence, you know?
And for a lot of people, because not just women, you know, but people of all genders were accused of witchcraft, of course, but often those words were the only words that would have been recorded in their entire
Absolutely.
Lives.
Yeah.
Because they couldn't read and write, most likely.
And if they could, it was probably part of the accusation could. Also.
Well, yeah, or if they could, that text is long gone.
Yeah.
So quite often, actually, the only record that we have of people who didn't have a formal education is what was said at trial. And women... I don't know if this is the case, the period you were looking at. Certainly, some of the research I did, women weren't allowed to give evidence in court, and children weren't either, unless it was a witch accusation.
Yeah.
And then women and children could give evidence. So actually, that's something that I wanted to do in this book as well. That again, it's about, you know, punching up, punching down. I'm not trying to kind of demonize anyone. I'm trying to say, you know, it's really complicated. If you give someone a young girl who no one has ever listened to, no one will ever listen to, and you say, here is somewhere where everyone will listen to you. Everyone will listen to what you have to say. I can see how it would be really hard to resist that. You know, you can say anything you want, and everybody listens, and everybody believes you. And I don't really think that that's good or bad. I think it's a complicated issue.
It is, and especially at the times that we're looking at. So both of these works take place a long time ago, but both the times are very, very different from each other. They're a couple of hundred years apart, which I found very interesting, that we might look back and go, oh, like the 16th or 17th century. Those two times are very different from each other. So I'd love to ask you both a bit about your experiences researching those times and the things that you came upon on those roads, because they are so abjectly foreign from where we are now. Like, a detail that struck me in Out She's Witch is that the protagonist has never seen her own reflection. No one has ever shown her a mirror, you know? Like, there's a doctor's daughter in your work, you know? Like, and the power that comes with that is also the kind of the curse of it. She makes herself so difficult for everybody because she's so educated. And they're 100, 200 years apart. I'd love to talk to you about those two different time periods and... what is it that drew you so far back into the past?
Well, I think I've already said I'm obsessed with history, but because the real trials were set in 1662, that's why I went back that far. And then once I started researching, it kind of became a very long rabbit hole. I felt like I needed to know everything about what happened to then work out how to tell the story.
An incredible detail in the work is that at the end, the names of the women who are burnt and or executed for witchcraft are listed. So the people from whom these stories have grown are named and acknowledged and witnessed and recorded in this book, which I found very moving. Like, it comes from a very real place. And seeing a real historical tribute to them was quite shocking in some ways.
Yeah, I mean, I guess when I first started looking at that history of the witch trials in Finnmark, there was over 100 people executed for witchcraft during the 17th century, which doesn't sound that much, but out of a population of 3,000, that is a big proportion. And it was one of the most ferocious witch hunts in Europe. And very much related to what was going on in Scotland, because the King of Denmark was the brother-in-law of the King of Scotland, James VI, and they were both obsessed with witch hunts. So you could say the first governor of Finnmark, up in the far north of Norway, who started witch hunts was a Scottish man. So you could say the Scots exported witch hunts to Finnmark.
You are welcome.
Because the ones that we hear about in pop culture and the ones that we see represented again and again in cinema and television are the American witch hunts and the American witch trials. So looking so closely at the violence and the procedural torture and excommunication of women in the north of the north, the Arctic Circle, it was very, very striking and very... even more so because it is so grounded in fact.
Very different from Salem.
Very different. Mm, yeah. Very, very different. And what about yourself, Christy? What brought you back in the...
Yeah,
time?
I mean, Now She's Witch, it's not set in a specific year. And the Middle Ages is a very long time period.
A long time.
Yeah, it's a really long time. And, you know, I spent a lot of time trying to decide which period I wanted to set it in. I did look at more the 1600s. I did look at more the kind of 1000s, 1200s. And neither of them felt quite right. So essentially, I just picked and chose whatever I wanted. I'm a real magpie when it comes to writing. I'm like, I'll have that. Someone told me this phrase, medievalism, which is, it's not medieval, but it's the themes and concerns and settings of that time period. But I'm not attempting to write a medieval novel because why would I and how could I? It was really difficult to think. I think when you write historical fiction, it's always difficult to think, how can I try and write a character who feels authentic to the time period but isn't so strange and offensive to a modern reader? Because, you know, someone who lived then would have many, many thoughts that we don't consider acceptable anymore. So then it's really difficult because you think, do I really want to re-harm people by doing these things?
In the name of a historical accuracy, which is unknowable.
And how do we even know? How do we even know? You know, particularly the characters that I'm writing, Lux and Els, my main characters, there are no records of them. There are no records of what they thought, what they said. So how could I possibly know? So number one, I don't think you can write actually accurate historical medieval fiction because it would be completely unreadable to a modern reader. And also, why? Why would you do it? I think the thing with historical fiction is we're always writing about now. Mm-hmm. We can't but write about now. And I think that that's why so many people are interested in witches and are writing about witches now. I unfortunately just found so many parallels. And it is easy for us to say it was a long time ago and things were different. And it was a long time ago and things were different, but unfortunately not that different. And you know, when you look at who was held responsible or who was accused in different places of witchcraft and of, it's always children. It's always, oh, think of the children, damage to children. It was women who didn't fit. It was older women who were seen as, quote, useless because they couldn't have babies anymore, either because they were having the menopause or they could just never have babies in the first place, which is the case for my main character. She never gets a period, so is seen as useless because she can't ever have a child. It was men. There's actually a man in my book who is killed as a witch, which was based on a real thing that happened at a monastery in France. A man was killed as a witch because he was very inconvenient, because he was saying very unpleasant and inconvenient things that nobody wanted to hear. So the easiest thing was for all, who knows to what extent anyone was complicit in this, but a lot of the nuns there were saying that he had sexually bewitched them because they were having these sexual dreams about him. They couldn't stop thinking about him. Clearly the only explanation was that he had bewitched them. So yeah, he was accused of a witch and he was killed as a witch. So it was anyone who was sort of inconvenient.
Too hot.
too hot. Just too sexy.
Gotta get rid of him.
Yeah. it was just anyone inconvenient, people who were disabled. There was a lot of attacks on Jewish people, people who were from different countries, people who just didn't fit, people who didn't perform their gender correctly, just anyone who didn't fit in. And that hasn't really changed. Like, the level of anti-Semitism, the level of transphobia and queerphobia and misogyny, it's different, but it's kind of the same as well.
Well, that's what it is with the stories, the moment or the period that we're living in contemporary literature, where books deal with witches and witchcraft of different stripes and different kinds. Play the conversations that we have about witches, even in the deepest past, reverberate so closely with the time of cultural panic and moral panic that we live in now. And I'd love to talk to you a bit about that, about the answer to the panic. Like, what can we learn from these trials? What can we learn from the sacrifices that these women of the distant past unknowingly made for us? Like, how can we go back there and take something to lead us forward? Big question, sorry.
Heavy solve it, Anya, yeah. Solve it.
Right, okay.
Digging in.
I was just going to add on about the you know, witch trials are still going on in the world now, in parts of India and in some countries in Africa, mainly women and children being accused. And the reasons they're being accused of witchcraft is the same, you know, for ruining crops or a sick child. So it really literally hasn't changed. Mm. But what's the solution? What can we learn and take from this? We need to, well, first of all, as a historical novelist, and I really agree with you, we're always writing about now, because how can, even though I, you know, did my best to be historically accurate, you know, it's my impression of the 17th century, of course.
It's an act of divination as well.
Yeah.
It's an act of divination and research. It comes through you and your experience lived in the world and your education and your own road.
Yeah.
You know, and it's a huge act of courage and of, like, a commitment to a period in time and the stories of people who are gone before, unknown and unnamed people who are gone before us.
I think it does come to a point where, when you're working so intensely with these characters, and I don't know if you felt like this, you're almost like channeling that energy from the past. And certainly I felt that, even though you said you didn't go deeply historically into the Middle Ages, for me, and I'm quite obsessed with the Middle Ages, it felt that you had that sensibility. I was saying to you earlier of the kind of the mystical and then the blood and shit. You know, you got the combination of that. But I think so we need to look at the past in a different way. We need to reappraise the past and tell the stories of those who haven't been told from the past to then help us change the way we perceive the present. And to dismantle that patriarchal structure that is still in the power structures, I guess. I don't know how we do that, though.
Yeah, I think when it comes to research, like, I read so much to do with the Middle Ages and with witches, which are such huge topics. You know, I must have read a stack of books this high, and I had another stack twice as high yet to read. And I did reach a point where I thought, I'm going to have to write this book at some point. Like, I can't read everything. There's no way I can read everything. It's impossible. I reached a point where I had sort of done enough research that I thought, I'm going to have to just go from here. But I think another thing about history that's worth thinking about is that history is written. And we often will hear phrases like, you can't rewrite history, which is nonsense, of course. People rewrite history all the time. You can't necessarily change facts, but it's all about interpretation, isn't it? So all the research I did, someone's interpreted that information and told it to me in a specific way. I didn't go and look at the actual records. And even if I did, someone has chosen what to preserve. Someone has decided what information is accessible to me and what information is not accessible to me. Either someone now in the modern day or someone at some point in the past has made that choice. So history is all stories, it's all interpretation.
Yeah.
It's not that there's no such thing as a fact, but there's no such thing as just a cold fact that just exists without interpretation. Everything is interpretation.
Mm-hmm. The details and the tiny textural moments of the work that come from research or something that really enthralled me. Both books concern food and hunger, and these are because these were hungry, gross times. Like, these were very bodily, very textured, very filthy times. I would love to ask you both about the food in each world. Everyone is hungry is a very broad statement, but when we inhabit the bodies of a set of characters, we feel very closely what they are feeling, and across the board, these are very hungry people. I would love to talk to you a bit about the different foods and the different, and obviously there's a lot of medicinal healing properties, a lot of poison in the work. So can you talk to me a bit about the eatable and uneatable of these different worlds? It's a set of details that I found really, really pleasurable and really enjoyable.
I love reading about food and writing about food. Historical food stuff is, I'm actually reading a book right now called Revolting Recipes that's like disgusting food throughout history, and it talks a lot about what we consider to be disgusting. It's very cultural, it's very historical. I am a big fan of haggis and black pudding, being Glaswegian. Some people find that disgusting, which I get. I'm not saying it's not disgusting. I'm saying I eat it. It's really interesting what we consider food and not food has changed. And one thing I found really interesting about the Middle Ages is, again, this kind of liminal space and these shifting boundaries and these shifting definitions. For example, when it was decided that the holy men were eating too much and getting too fat, and that was seen as gluttonous and therefore unholy, it was decided that they could only eat meat on certain days, and there were a lot of days where they weren't allowed to eat meat. So they just recategorized what was meat and what was fish. So this is in the book, actually, that a frog was a fish. Basically, anything that lived on or near water was a fish, therefore could be eaten on a non-meat day, which I found really interesting. Like, I think geese were a fish because they are near water. So I really like that. I like that you can just change the definition. If you don't like the rule, you're like, I shall simply change the definition. And I like that, that it's these kind of shifting definitions. And I think we think that there was some kind of magical point in the past where everything was very clear and there were clear boundaries and we knew what was what. We never did. And we never will.
Ebbed and shifted depending on the Lord's edicts and humours and what was feastable and what was not feastable, you know.
And not even what the Lord said, what people said about what the Lord said. Do you know what I mean?
Magic of gossip.
Exactly. It's all coming through various channels, isn't it? Yeah. How are we going to interpret this?
And Anya?
So, yeah, the food in the world in Finnmark is a very big part, actually, of the actual witch hunts, because the community living up there are mainly fishermen, and fish is a big part of culture. In Norway still, is it bigger than the oil industry? The fishing industry maybe is the second biggest industry in Norway. I don't know if there's any Norwegians here, but Norwegian people love fish. So it's a big part of the culture, and it's very tied in with the witch hunts, because what was happening at that time in the 17th century was there was a mini ice age. So for hundreds of years, it had actually been quite a wealthy district, bizarrely, up in the far north above the Arctic, because the fishermen were able to send their fish down. They would trade with the Bergen merchants in the south of Norway, and they would get money for that going off to, you know, the Catholic world for all the fasting days. But anyway, because the mini ice age was coming in, the fishing yields were going further south, and the fishermen were getting into debt with the Bergen merchants who they were trading with for grain. And when the fishermen started to complain, their wives started being accused of witchcraft by the merchants, which was very convenient to kind of distract them from the actual issue of hunger. So the women were accused, literally accused, of chasing the fish away on stalks of sea or legs of seaweed. And in the book, it's quite interesting you're talking about meat and stuff, because in the book, one of my characters, Maren, is a vegan. And I'm like, of course there were vegans in the 17th century. Why couldn't there be vegans in the 17th century? So I try to, like, in each one of my books, just drop in a wee little vegan, you know, just to say they don't exist then. So she won't eat any flesh or fish. And but she actually, as the others are starving because they can't get enough fish, she actually is able to feed herself from the land. So I did a lot of research into looking at what can you eat in the Arctic that isn't meat or fish.
What grows in the cold?
Yeah. Tubers and all sorts of interesting things. And it was really fun, actually. Mm. I'm not sure it'd be that tasty, but...
And a lot of poor people in the Middle Ages would have been vegan.
Yeah.
Because meat was very expensive. And a cow was a huge luxury. So
the one thing the family has, like the one beast the family owns, your single object of worth. You know?
Even having a cow, you know, my characters wouldn't have had that at all. And almond milk was a big thing in the Middle Ages, which I didn't realize. You know, you think of almond milk as being quite modern, quite, you know, you're sitting with your MacBook in the coffee shop with your almond milk. But it was really common. You'd be more likely to have almond milk than cow's milk because there was no refrigeration, so cow's milk would go off really, really quickly. So almond milk made perfect sense. And lots of vegetables, so it actually would have been quite a reasonably healthy diet because it would be almond milk and a lot of vegetables, whereas the richer people would have a lot of meat and a lot of sugar, so they would have a less healthy diet as well.
Yeah, the health and the body comes into it a lot as well. Like these people are giving themselves gout and poisoning themselves kind of continually. Like I said, they're very bodily, very textured. You feel very alive and also equally very kind of horrified by your own body while you're reading them. I think that's what's nice about it. You're about this kind of work that's situated at a grosser time is that it calls to attention how absolutely alive and kind of writhing we are. Another question that I had, I'm very mindful of time, so if any of you have questions, please hold them because I'm going to turn to the floor in a few minutes to see if any of you have anything to ask. Both of these books deal with the triptych, the maiden, mother, and crone of the great story of the witch and the great story of womanhood is these three different stages of life. And I found that really, really compelling. These different kinds of mothers or different kinds of daughters and those relationships. I would love to ask you both about those because motherhood or chosen family are very much at the core of both of them in different ways. Or family you sort of find yourself with by accident and you just have to deal with it. And I'd love to talk to you about those themes in the work because they're, for me anyway, at the heart of lots of the relationships in the stories.
Mm. Okay, will I go first? Mm-hmm. So I guess one of the reasons I wanted to write about the 1662 witch trials was because one of the features of it was that six little girls testified against their mothers and their aunts, and I just thought, my God, how could that happen? So at the core of the book is this fundamental, you know, mother-daughter question, mother-daughter relationship, and how the women were accused of sacrificing their daughters to the devil, and how it was viewed that, you know, being in league with the devil was something you inherited within your family. So how a child would be branded as the daughter of a witch and kind of marked for that. So I wanted to delve into different relationships with mothers. So, you know, we have this character, Sigvald's daughter, and she's a bad mother, you could say, and I don't want to give any spoilers away, but she's two daughters. One of them is one of the main characters, Ingeborg, and she almost takes on the role of the mother with her sister Kirsten, who's a very problematic relationship with her mother. But then we go to the other character, Anna Rudis, who I guess we could view as, I don't like to use the word crone, but she is the older woman in the book. She's the feisty crone character, but she's also has a kind of a relationship with mothers and daughters in the sense that as we meet her at the beginning of the book, she doesn't have a child as we meet her at the beginning of the book. But one of the things that I wanted to investigate with Anna was actually, I felt it was quite important to have a character she's not defined by motherhood. And she does say this at some point. She's like, well, actually, it's what was more important to me was that I actually was able to be a doctor like all the men, that I was actually able to have a voice in this male-dominated world. So I wanted to kind of play with that as well, and investigate those different stages. But one of the, you know, important thing was that every kind of generation of woman was involved in the story and was accused of witchcraft. So you had mothers, you had daughters, you had older widowed women as well at that time.
It's like a dark torch that gets passed down. You know, it's an intergenerational curse that women sort of experience in these worlds. You know?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. It's fantastic. And Christy, what about
you?
Yeah,
I love that you characterised it that way. Actually, the second bit that I was going to read is kind of to do with mothers. But yeah, there are sort of three... Well, there are lots of women characters in the book, but yeah, there's we have Lux, the main character, who I guess is a maiden, and then we have her mother, who is killed as a witch. We find that out at the start of the book. And she's kind of the crone, and she's viewed with suspicion because she's seen as sort of too old to be the mother of this child. So everyone's kind of saying, where did she get it from? Who did she take it from? Who gave her this child? And then we have Else, who is sort of in between the two. So I guess she's kind of the mother. But then what I really wanted to play with, went on quite an unexpected personal journey while writing this book. Around the same time I started it, my wife and I started to try and have a baby. And it took about as long as the book, so about 6 years. And our original plan was that my wife would carry the baby. It seems like I'm really sharing a lot. I did write a book about this called The Unfamiliar, which is coming out in July. So it's okay. I have okayed all this sharing already with my wife. But yeah, originally that was the plan. She was going to be the birth mom. I didn't particularly want to be the birth mom. And that's what we were going to do. And it just didn't work out that way. It just, your body doesn't do what you want it to do. We inhabit our bodies, but we don't necessarily control them. So in the end, what happened was I ended up being the birth mom. And it just got me thinking a lot about how our bodies, we really demonize and even criminalize people whose bodies won't do certain things that we think that they should do. And it just really made me think, even if we wanted our bodies to do certain things, we can't make them do things that they're not going to do. And it also made me think about how we define a woman and what is a woman. Because I think, you know, we're both women. One of us has had a child and one of us hasn't. And some people would say that one of us is sort of more of a mother than the other, or even more of a woman than the other, because one of us could have a child and one of us couldn't. And I mean, of course, that's absolutely ridiculous, but that's still something that a lot of people would say. And it just made me think a lot about, you know, what is a woman then? What is a mother? And how, again, just like what is a witch? It's not as simple as we might like it to be. But I think that that's beautiful. I think that that makes it more wonderful. I think that there's so much beauty in these liminal spaces and in these kind of shifting boundaries. So it made me think, yeah, really a lot about that, you know. And one thing that I have found really wonderful is the way that all of our families love our child so much. And he has got 6 grandparents. So there's my mum and stepdad. There's my wife's mum and stepdad. There's my wife's dad and stepmum. So he's got 6. He's biologically related to 1 of them. But you wouldn't know. Nobody cares. Nobody even has mentioned it or thought of it. They just think he's like he's the lord of everybody, to be honest. And I just love that. And it's just made me think that I just love these liminal spaces and I love these shifting boundaries. And I think that the world can be so beautiful if we kind of open up our definitions of things.
I think that's the cure then, isn't it? The restoration for that deeply Christian, cruel, ruling, patriarchal system that we explore in both of those books. The answer then is a softening, surely, and a rebuilding of things into something more collective.
Yeah, I think it's a moving beyond an us and them. It's moving beyond thinking, yeah, those people are different. Mm. Those people aren't like me. They're somehow not as human as me. They're not as real as me. Their pain doesn't hurt like mine does. And I think it's about realizing that we're all human.
Mm.
Thanks for listening to the ILFD podcast. International Literature Festival Dublin is a Dublin City Council initiative kindly supported by the Arts Council.